Well, of course, everybody is pretty much aware that a week ago today, actually, Muhammad Ali, the great fighter and wonderful man, passed away. Today is his funeral. He will be starting his very last journey in about an hour's time from the Louisville Funeral Home, where his body lays in rest, and it will continue on its 23-mile journey to the place where he will be laid to rest forever. Now then, obviously, people are gathering. I think you can see from the television reports, it's suggested that there are going to be tens of thousands of people coming out to pay their last respects, and of course many, many celebrities. But here now we are going to be focusing on somebody who knew him personally as a friend, a good friend of Muhammad Ali and his family, and moreover perhaps the definitive biographer of the great fighter. That gentleman is Davis Miller. He is the author of one of many books, especially Approaching Ali, which is perhaps his most definitive guide to Ali's life. And I'm delighted to welcome you to the program, Davis.
Good morning. It's entirely an honor to be here.
Well, thank you. You are now in Louisville. I spoke to you yesterday. You were driving across the country to get there. Give me an idea. In an hour, you'll be heading to the funeral home. Is that correct?
Yes, shortly. And I have very mixed feelings about it. He was the seminal person in my life, other than my own parents and my children and the two wives I've had. I'll miss him every single breath I take from now to the end of my life.
Well, your name is very familiar to aficionados of Muhammad Ali, because obviously you were a big biographer of the man. But your relationship with him, a personal relationship, which developed from a very personal struggle that you encountered. Can you just take us back and give us a background as to why you became friends with Muhammad Ali?
Well, firstly, and I don't want to take too much backstory here, but the first time I ever saw him is when so many millions of people did. It was January 1964, and he was training to fight Sonny Liston. I was an 11-year-old child at the time, and my mom had just died. And I blamed myself for her death. She was only 32. We didn't know she was sick. And so I stopped eating and even stopped taking fluids and had to be admitted to hospital a couple times. The second time when I got out, I was sitting sadly in front of my father's little black and white TV, turning from channel to channel, and suddenly I hit on his channel, and it was his voice and his face, and the voice said, "I'm young, I'm handsome, I'm fast, I'm pretty, and can't possibly be beat." And I felt lit up. I felt he woke me up in the moment. And all through my tough adolescence, where I was the smallest kid in my school at 16, I was 4'10" and weighed 63 pounds. And my nickname was Fetus. I mean, you don't get much worse than that. But I lived vicariously through Ali. And so there was some safe place in me that people couldn't touch. Many, many, many years later, I was clerking in video stores and movie shops in his hometown of Louisville, where I'm standing now, and found out that I was losing my job, hugely depressed, married, wife, two young children, mortgage. And as I was driving home from learning that, I coincidentally drove past a house I knew to be his mom's house, and there was this block-long, ivory-colored recreational vehicle parked in front with license plates that read, "The Greatest." And you know, who else could that be, especially in Louisville, Kentucky? And I thought, well, I need to thank this man for what he's meant to my life, even on this tough afternoon. And so I worked up my courage, parked behind his recreational vehicle, and went up to knock on the door. I didn't even get my hand to the door, because as I was reaching to knock, he opened it, and he was standing there, looming in front of me. He looked as big as God. He was so huge, he had to lean under the frame of the doorway to see me.
Gosh.
And he looked like some grand glowing house atop a hill. And he gently waved me in, did magic tricks for me for about a half hour. He was a fine amateur magician. and signed a bunch of things. And then he motioned me out into his mom's front yard. I'd been a professional kickboxer in my 20s because of him. And we started play boxing in his mother's front yard. And cars stopped all around the house, and kids on bicycles. There were 5 cars, then 15, then 25. And people sitting on their hoods and screaming and yelling, "Hey, champ, hey, champ." And after we'd moved for a minute, he leaned over toward my ear and said, "Come on in the house." By that time, he'd had Parkinson's disease already about 15 years, and so he didn't speak much. He invited me in to dinner with his mom and his younger brother, Rahman. I knew in the moments that it was changing me, but I didn't know how. It felt like an out-of-body experience. I've never done drugs. I've never done LSD. But if I had, it couldn't have felt more otherworldly. And I knew by the time I left there that evening that I wanted to write about the experience. I sold a story to Esquire, Esquire magazine, though I'd never been published. When it was published, it instantly became famous, and was eventually judged one of the 20 best pieces of sport writing of the 20th century.
Goodness.
And even more recently, one of the 40 all-time world's best magazine stories. And it launched me. And I kept hanging out with Muhammad, kept hanging out with Ali. We got closer and closer, became friends. I kept writing more and more intimate stories about him, with him sort of being both Superman in decline and my best pal, and sort of an ailing family member to the world. You know, he in retirement and with his Parkinson's disease, he became something of a ailing grandfather to some of us, to some of the rest of us, father or brother, and that's the way I write about him. And my editor, when he sent me my copies of this new book, Approaching Ali, he enclosed a little note that said, "Davis, this is the book about Muhammad Ali that's going to be read 100 years from now." His wife, Lonnie, read it to him a few weeks ago aloud. My wife and I have a new 6-week-old son who we've named after Muhammad, and I adore him. I'd be selling, I don't know what I'd be doing, selling used cars in a terrible lot if it weren't for Muhammad Ali. He entirely changed my life, as he did so many millions and millions of people. I think he may be the world's most loved man, and I'm going to miss him forever.
Having found the courage to knock on his door, that's the defining moment, isn't it? Listening to you describe how you were, you probably weren't a man of who would take a risk like that previously, but Muhammad Ali somehow had already given you that courage even before you'd met him to take that step and knock on that door.
No one has ever said that before, and that is absolutely true. He made me believe I could do anything, and he did that with so many of us all over the world. There's no place in the world where people don't revere Ali. If there is any exception, it's actually the United States. He's probably more highly regarded really everywhere else in the world than here. I hear stories every day, and I'm interviewed by people. Well, you're one of them. You know, I'm interviewed by people everywhere. And just a few months ago, I met someone here in Louisville from Beijing, and his name is Chin Wu, and he is teaching at New York University, NYU, and his particular field of scholarship is how Muhammad Ali has influenced the Chinese people. And those are the classes he teaches. And I asked Chin Wu, I said, "Well, you know, the people in China know Ali." And he smiled and he said, "Everybody know Ali." He said, "Some people think he legend, some people think he already died, but everybody know Ali." And I said, "Do they know Elvis?" And Chin Wu himself didn't know who Elvis was. He didn't know any of Ali's opponents, not George Foreman, Joe Frazier, Sonny Liston. it's just Ali is this singular mythic figure. And he's a transformative figure, not only in my life, but in you know, everyone. From Bill Clinton is doing the eulogy today, along with John F. Kennedy. Ali was Bill Clinton's main hero. The same is true for Barack Obama. The same is true for people all over the world who are doing wondrous work, or just struggling to get by each day. We all love the guy.
For if we go back again to the days of the Vietnam War, I mean, it was one thing really for anybody to stand up and say, this is not something I'll be part of. But for a black man to do it at that time was of double... It was just immense, wasn't it? That absolute stand that he took against the Vietnam War, against the American government, as a black man, was so powerful.
Yes, yes, yes. And he continued to stand up. In the U.S. again, that made him loathed. That made him reviled by many people.
Yeah.
And I still hear from Vietnam vets who strongly, strongly dislike him. And but around the world, that, you know, people greatly admired that incredible act of courage. He sacrificed his career. He lost his fortune because of it. He was not allowed to box for almost 4 years, I mean, the period that would have been his prime. He could not leave the country. They took his passport. And I think eventually it's part of what cost him his health, because when he came back, he was never as light on his feet, never quite as quick as he'd been before, though in many respects he became a more complete boxer. His skills in some respects were better, but he was no longer that impossibly quick guy you could not hit. And I think it also possibly damaged his health because he stayed around longer than he should have. He'd never really gotten his due. And so when he knocked out George Foreman in Zaire in 1974, at almost 33 years old, he was already very old for a boxer. And he stayed around for many more years. Oh, how he loved to box. I mean, I boxed with him. You know, as a wannabe kickboxer in 1975, I went to his training camp in Deer Lake, Pennsylvania, and hopped in the ring with him. And he would have sparred you, Pippa. he fought everybody from 3-year-old toddlers to their 95-year-old great grandmamas, and he just loved it. And he was such a showman. When I got in the ring with him, he'd never boxed with a kickboxer before. So I threw kicks at him in addition to punches, and he'd probably never even seen kicks before. This is way back in 1975, and he got out of the way of them as easily as if he'd been doing it his whole life. And he went back and laid on the ropes. I'm 5'7". He was 6'3½" at the time. And he laid on the second strand of ropes, sat on them, so that he pulled his head down to my height, and then beckoned me in with a wave of gloves and in his rope-a-dope. And I had been watching him. You know, I'd seen him for tens of thousands of hours, and I thought I could catch him with a shot. And so I threw three shots, two of which were kickboxing blows he'd never seen before, actually managed to hit him, which was a mistake. He'd been, you know, sort of sleepwalking through it until then, and it woke him up, and he came off of the ropes and hit me with a single jab, and my legs went to soup. I couldn't see. I couldn't hear. Spectators sounded as if they were 18 miles away. And, you know, anybody else would have knocked me out. And what he did instead is he just draped a long arm around my shoulders and said, "You're fast, and you sure can hit to be so little." And as far as I was concerned, he may as well have said he was adopting me. And that's my friend, Muhammad Ali. He treated basically everyone as if they were family, really didn't exclude hardly anyone, a towering figure of our lifetimes. And I think as long as they're human beings, and I can't say if we nuke each other off of the planet in the next 50 years or 100 years or global warm ourselves out of here, but if we're around, I think people will know the name Muhammad Ali.
It's fitting as well, or is it serendipity? Who knows why things happen the way they do? But we are at a time in the United States where you have a presidential yes. race just about to take place. One of those candidates has been fairly vociferous in some pretty negative comments he's made about Muslims. And here we have Muhammad Ali, who yesterday was given a farewell tribute by many Muslims. I think also in Louisville there was a commemoration for him there, an Islamic funeral service. Here we are, it's Ramadan. We've got Donald Trump shouting off about not allowing Muslims into America, and perhaps the most adored man in the world, who was himself an American Muslim, is here, is about to be laid to rest, and the focus of the world is on your country.
Yes, it is. Thank you. And I think very many Americans don't understand that. I won't say it's a secondary news item here, because it is not. Mm. It's primary. But Americans do not realize that the focus of the entire world is on our country through our great and maybe greatest son, Muhammad Ali. In addition to being American, he's also arguably the first genuinely international human being. Barack Obama is also an international man, and I think that's many Americans have trouble with Barack Obama, and I think for not dissimilar reasons. But Barack Obama, could there have been Barack Obama as president if there had not been Muhammad Ali?
Yeah.
I think his influence is so round and deep and wide that we don't even appreciate what all of it is yet. Don't even know what all of it is yet. I mean, there's a Muhammad Ali of everything. You know, Bill Clinton was kind of a Muhammad Ali of politics, and there's Muhammad Ali's all through the entertainment world and in every sport. I mean, all sports. I mean, you talk to any contemporary sports idols or very fine athletes, and so very many of them will tell you that Ali was their idol growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I mean, I think apart from all of it, just a human being he's very much unlike anybody else. He's singular. There's something about him that's singular. I don't think there's. He said it all the time. I mean, he said, "After me, there will never be another." And at one time, maybe he meant that about boxing, but it's so much wider than that. His fear of influence and the way he's adored, it's possible that Muhammad Ali positively influenced and transformed the lives of more people in his own lifetime than anyone ever has.
It's remarkable as well to imagine that the words that would come out of Ali's mouth about how good he was, coming out of another's mouth would sound ridiculous. But Muhammad Ali had a message which was far greater than telling people about how great he was. It was a means of allowing people or getting people to listen to him and to really try and understand the man. And I think my favourite reference to anything he said is where he refers to service to others is the rent that you pay for your time here on earth. For me, it sums that up.
And he lived that way, which still many people don't recognize, because he was so boisterous, he was so loud. in his private life, long before he had Parkinson's disease, he was a very quiet man. When he spoke, it was hardly louder than a whisper, and you'd sometimes have to lean over to try and hear him. And he treated really almost everyone as if they were family. I've seen him let complete strangers into his life, sometimes even street people, who he would who he would take and clean up, buy them clothes, give them money, help find them jobs or psychological counseling. I've seen him go into hospitals and pick up children and hold them to his chest who were dying of very communicable diseases, kiss them on their faces, even though he could have caught it, and he didn't even flinch. I was with him one time at his home in Michigan, near Chicago, when we were watching a television story about the Chicago school system could not afford buses. And Muhammad got up, very Parkinson's disease walk, and moved over to his desk in almost a great-grandfatherly fashion, just shuffled over there and pulled out his checkbook and handed it to me and asked me to write the check for $500,000, which he then signed. And he asked me to put it in an envelope and mail it to the Chicago school board, which I did with a little note that said, you know, this is to buy buses. He didn't. At that point, he was not world-class wealthy either. He was worth, more money than I'll ever have, and I bet than you have. He was worth a few million dollars, but he just gave away $500,000 to buy buses. He didn't. Take it off of his taxes. He didn't do anything. That's the way he was. Another time, I remember standing, and I write about this in Approaching Ollie, this particular incident, that I'd just come back from working on a movie in Hong Kong, and I hated the work. I mean, it was rotten. I did not like the producers or the directors. They were not nice people, and I felt like I needed a bath. I felt so soiled and dirty, and I was in Los Angeles, knew that Muhammad was doing a signing at a little bookshop. And I thought, okay, I need something real. I need Muhammad Ali. So I took a cab to that bookshop and hung out with him for a couple of hours. And after the signing, I said, you know, champ, I haven't seen my wife and kids in a month. Is it possible? Could I get a ride to the airport with you? And he was with his best friend, Howard Bingham, and we all got in the car. And we were driving through East L.A., which is where the riots were in 92, and this was 93. And at a bus stop, there were a lot of people, 10 people, 12 people, hanging out at the bus stop. And Ali lifted his shaking right finger and pointed. And Howard, his best friend, knew that meant that Muhammad wanted him to pull over there. And we did. And Ali comes rolling out of the car, puts his hands up behind his head, goes up to a kind of a squat, little tank of a man, and says, "You look like Joe Frazier." It starts throwing punches, real light punches at him. And soon there's instead of 10 people, there's 25 people, then 100 people. And it was like that everywhere in the world with Ali. And he, after he kidded around with everybody for a few minutes, he reached into his pocket and took out his wallet and opened it up. And I think he'd been paid in cash by the bookshop where he'd been doing this signing, and he starts pulling out $20 bills, $50 bills, and giving them to everyone on the street corner. And he'd say, "No wine, food, buy clothes, and gave it out to all of the, to each person until he'd given out everything in his wallet. Thousands of dollars. And then he said, stay here. I'll be back. And we got back in the car and went to an ATM. He got out however much money the ATM would let him have. We went back, and there's probably 20, 25 people still there, and he gave all of that out to. And that was Muhammad Ali.
Wow, Davis, what an amazing story. Incredible to listen to you. And your privilege that you had in knowing such an incredible human being is really second to none, isn't it? Tell me, I'm sure you must be, in half an hour, I think the funeral procession sets off. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I'm very ambivalent about seeing it. Probably try and stay a little bit away from it as much as I can. Mm. I mean, my Muhammad Ali is my private, personal friend, and most of the time we spent together, it was just that. It was not in big crowds. We had some of that, but yeah. It was mostly the two of us, or him and me, and his family members. My family members, and for that reason, I almost didn't come to Louisville, but thought that I'd sort of honor him in some other way. Mm. But here I am, and it's necessary for me to tell him goodbye.
And moreover, for you to generously have shared your memory of him today for us is just wonderful, Davis. I can't thank you enough. Davis Miller, whose most recent biography is Approaching Ali. I think that's going to be selling even more copies now, sadly, because he's died. The great man has died. But Davis, thank you so very much for joining us. You've been incredibly generous with your time.
Thank you, and you're a pleasure to speak with you. We have good flow together. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you, Davis Miller. I look forward to speaking to you again. All the very best for today. I hope you stay safe.
Thank you, Pippa. Will do.